Because one, this has been tried before and has not been as successful as we wanted. And second, we've got a lot of new people on the complex that worked here in the past few decades. And most importantly, we want everyone giving us their innovative ideas for future improvements. So underlying all of these initiatives, of course, is a risk-based approach. That's the way we do engineering, that's the way we do science, that's the way we do streamlining, because we have to assure that we never compromise safety, security, or quality, but that we keep our people laser-focused on the requirements we put on to eliminate, mitigate, or manage the risks, on identifying the known risks, applying the requirements that will eliminate them, that because we know that those risks, safety, security, and quality, can impact our people and certainly our missions. It's really an honor for us at Long and Eckert Associates to work with Kim and Tom and Laura and all the labs and all the plants and sites, because I think the commitment that it takes to do this very important national and international job is just incredible. I think the lab directors probably have the hardest job in the entire complex. So let me start by thanking them for their commitment and leadership as we work our way towards furthering and strengthening the NSA production culture. But let's begin the discussion. First, what are some of the ongoing activities at your lab to streamline mission delivery by implementing this risk-based approach? So, Kim, do you want to start with that and then to Tom?
Sure thing, John. Thank you, and thanks for having us here today. Thanks for joining us virtually so that we can keep our panel on track. We're doing a lot of things to really try to streamline our approach at the laboratory. That's everything from thinking about how we operate the site, to how we do our business, to how we do science and engineering, to how we connect science and engineering and design to engineering and production tools. So on the operations front, there's a huge number of things happening, and this is really a big win, I think, for the enterprise. That's bringing AI tools into our facilities, understanding, for example, how to do things like predictive maintenance by better utilizing the data we collect from these large, complex facilities that we run. It's streamlining our business approaches so that we can spend more time on important mission-focused activities and less time on what I would call compliance or back office activities. You know, how do we optimize for what's really needed? And then in the science arena, it really is an amazing moment in time. So over the last few years, we've spent an enormous amount of effort trying to understand how to exploit these new emerging tools to really change the way we think about design. So for example, we had a project to integrate AI and machine learning tools into our modern design frameworks so that we can start with an endpoint and do an inverse design process. So understand the requirements and then work backward to the optimal technology solution. That's just one example. We've also taken those design optimization tools and begun to connect outputs of design to our engineering and production tools. So we had a project where we built a loop, an AI loop, to manage one of our additive manufacturing machines. So we can manage the manufacturing process, monitor it, and create an on-the-fly digital twin as we're building a part so that we have the opportunity at the end of that process to know exactly what we built and to, in the future, hopefully be creating products that are board certified. So each of these steps, if you think about putting that whole loop together, it will change the way we think about design, what the options are, what kind of materials we can use, how quickly we can move from design concepts to production, and then how quickly we can move from production to certified products out the door. And of course, the really critical step in that arena is working with our enterprise partners to make sure that the new technologies we develop, the new approaches we develop, are built and deployed with them working together with us from the very beginning. So we've got very strong partnerships across the NSC with Kansas City, with Y-12, with Pantex, with Los Alamos, really trying to see how we can make this whole cycle much more effective.
So maybe I can pick up and first off, just everything that Kim said, I could echo. So instead, I'll try and talk about some different things. You know, as you mentioned, John, we are We are delivering a lot right now. It was about a year ago in January of 2025 that we had a celebration at Pantex for the last production unit of the B-6112. And then in very short order in the spring, we had a celebration of the first production unit of the B-6113, which was more than a year ahead of the schedule that had been, you know, communicated to Congress. A couple of months ago, in the closing weeks of 2025, we celebrated the last production unit of the W88 Alt-370. So there's been a lot of work with the modernization program, getting modernized weapons out into the stockpile, and that's been enabled by a lot of hard work across the country at the plants and on the federal side, and certainly with our colleagues at Sandia, that we play an important part in every weapons system. But as wonderful as that is, we understand and we know that, in fact, we're being asked to do more. At a time that we're very, very busy, we're being asked to do more. And although we've been fortunate in terms of the funding that we've received, there's a lot of bipartisan support in Congress for our mission. And as a result, the budgets, the budget that was just enacted for this year are going up. But there's a big hill to climb on the infrastructure side, and we're not in a position where we can just say, we'll throw money at the problem. We have to work more cost effectively. And some of those things are actually very low-tech, and some of them are very high-tech. So let me give you some examples of some maybe lower-tech things that we've been doing. Over the course of 2025, we tripled the productivity of the infrastructure work that we're doing in the PF4 plant, removing glove boxes and old obsolete glove boxes and bringing new ones in service of the pit mission. And that was not an easy task, but fundamentally it was pretty simple. At the start of last year, we were working 4 10-hour shifts a week, and by the spring we'd gone to 24/7. So sometimes people will say you can't add more hours to the day. Well, you can add more hours to the day when you're working 4 10s. Neglects a lot of very difficult work in terms of how we're going to support the back shift operations, make sure people have the ability to tap into the expertise they need and the equipment they need and so forth. So it was not an easy thing to do, but it doesn't require a quantum computer. It does require a lot of really dedicated people solving problems in real time. When we first transitioned to 24/7, we did it earlier than we planned, partly because we knew we're going to learn a lot when we try and do this. We're going to find out what the gaps are, where we get stuck, unable to perform work, and we're going to be able to solve those problems. And by the time we got to the end of the year, it was really showing results as we're pulling ahead of our schedules in terms of the infrastructure work. So that was an example of a kind of low-tech thing, but very, very important. And there's a lot more to do in terms of efficiency that we can accomplish. Some of it is in some of the regulatory areas. You heard from the field office managers in the previous panel, a lot of accomplishments in that area. But on the more high-tech side, the example I'd like to say is another one where we've been using artificial intelligence. For our design activities, high-performance computing is an absolutely essential part of how we design our weapons. It has been since computers were people in the 1940s. And we use the models to certify the weapons in the first place as they're designed, iterate the designs, and optimize the designs, and then also as part of the ongoing assessment project, as our surveillance program reveals effects of aging, to verify that that's not an issue that needs remediation through some sort of modernization effort. And those computations are extraordinarily computationally expensive, because especially for aging phenomena that tend to kind of break the symmetries that we use to simplify the models, you've got to do full-up 3D multiphysics calculations. Well, one of the things that we know AI is good for is actually doing surrogate simulations where you use the results of simulations to train a neural network that can then emulate those high-fidelity multiphysics simulations much, much faster. This has been demonstrated in weather prediction where AI-trained accelerations, for example, tracking hurricanes, have demonstrated that they are more accurate than the multiphysics simulations and orders of magnitude faster. Well, we've been doing the same thing in support of our national security mission, where one of the things we have to do is model high explosives and how the burn front propagates in rather complicated geometries. Well, we trained a neural network in an unclassed environment using test problems, basically. And now that we have our Venado supercomputer on the classified network, which is well optimized for artificial intelligence, we can run surrogate calculations that are 20 times faster. And that 20 times makes a big difference because it means that, particularly when you go to the full coupled equations that include all the phenomena, not just the high explosives, you know, those are still very time consuming. You can only do a limited number of them to analyze different design options. Well, now all of a sudden we have the possibility with these significant performance gains to really explore the parameter space and better optimize future designs. So two examples, one kind of low tech, but really important. The other one kind of at the cutting edge of what we can do with artificial intelligence.
Tremendous, thank you. Let's go to infrastructure now, because as we all know, the facilities are 75 years old, right? We've got all of the 75th anniversary celebrations, except here in Nevada, which we had to delay. But what's been the progress in building the infrastructure you need at the labs to support your missions as outlined in the Enterprise Blueprint? Tom, do you want to start with that one?
Well, I already mentioned the progress that we're experiencing in the PF4 facility. There's still a lot to do on that front. I think we've now reached the point where we're actually now starting to have serious conversations with the administration about can we go faster. I think a year ago, I would have been reluctant to have those conversations before we made this transition to 24/7 operations, but now I think there are prospects for doing that. So. But beyond PITS, it's not just our plutonium infrastructure that is in need of modernization. We have a host of facilities that date back, in some cases, to the Cold War, early Cold War. Our high explosives facilities, our Lance accelerator, and they're all in various stages of decrepitude and in need of some sort of intervention. You know, we've recently brought online some new facilities, facilities where we do flight integration tests for our stockpile systems, and a facility that supports our DARPA operations, and they were completed, you know, very cost effectively and on schedule. And part of the approach that we're taking is trying more and more to take advantage of the leeway that we're getting in terms of commercial construction standards. You know, obviously our nuclear facilities are kind of unique. They're even unique in the context of nuclear facilities, and so they do require kind of a bespoke approach. But a lot of our facilities are fairly conventional, even if they include laboratory facilities or high bays, they're not that different from standard commercial practices, and obviously office facilities fall into that category. And unfortunately, I think we've worked ourselves into a frame of mind where we were kind of applying our unique bespoke nuclear methodology to absolutely everything that we did. And that was not helpful because it extends the timelines, increases the cost, and doesn't give you any real benefits, since the hazards associated with those operations are no different than normal office or light-duty industrial space. And so that's something that was certainly helpful in those two examples that I cited. And as we look at some of the workload ahead of us in modernizing our non-nuclear facilities, it's the only way we're going to get there. The ditch that we're in terms of infrastructure is pretty deep. We're going to have to dig out of it in the most cost-effective way possible. Otherwise, it's going to take forever, and it'll you know, it'll cost us too much of our national treasure.
Sure. So again, I agree wholeheartedly. We've made a lot of progress. I'll give you a few examples from our site. So we have been at the forefront of applying new streamlined approaches to commercial light construction. So a few years back, we built a new emergency operations center under these streamlined authorities. It was an under $50 million project. We delivered that facility under budget, ahead of time, with additional scope, simply by applying commercial standards. Today, we're executing the first under $100 million streamlined project. It's our digital infrastructure capability expansion. Someone showed me a picture of the facility where all of our connections to the outside world reside, which has been on our site for about 40 years. And I haven't really slept since I saw the picture of what was in that building, like crammed over rafters with wires and cables, a huge risk item. So now we have a new, modern, expanded facility that commercial construction is complete on. We're beginning to kit it out to update that again. $80 million project done under these streamlined authorities and commercial approaches, delivering on time, you know, ahead of schedule in many cases and under budget. So really very successful. We have more proposals in the pipeline. Our site made very extensive use of the STAR office building concept. So these were standard plans for GPP scale buildings that could be replicated easily. We built a lot of them on our site. Now, for those of you not familiar with Livermore, we're a 1 square mile site. So building $30 million one-story tall office buildings is not a great strategy. It's sort of self-limiting. So now we are working with NNSA on a line item proposal to build a large-scale office building to house our national security work, the National Security Innovation Center. That will be somewhere in the neighborhood of 800 offices. So we have not had a major investment in our office space in a very long time. And this is really desperately needed given the amount of modernization work we have going on right now. And so we're hopeful that we'll be able to do that procurement again under these streamlined authorities. It is an office building. It has some special needs, classified space, et cetera, but it's something that's should be well ready to be executed in this space. So we're cautiously optimistic that that will go forward under those proposals and we'll be able to show that there's a better way forward. On the scientific front, we're also trying to modernize our facilities. In some cases, that's taking very old infrastructure, some of our AG facilities at our second site, Site 300, where the buildings are sturdy, but the interiors need to be re-kitted. So we've done a lot of work on recapitalizing facilities and reusing valuable infrastructure in that way. But in other places, like the National Ignition Facility or Laser Facility, the facility's been operating at full capacity for 15 years. We've done 4,000 experiments. We started building that facility in the early 2000s. It's very old for a high-tech facility. So we're embarked on two major projects there, one to sustain the facility and replace systems that are past their useful life, repair some of the normal wear and tear that's gone on in that facility over time. For example, the way the laser works is that it has these cassettes of flash lamps that fire and put energy into the laser glass. Those flash lamp cassettes have degraded. They need to be taken apart and cleaned and reassembled. So straightforward work, but you know the scale of it is pretty immense for a facility with 192 laser beams. We also have been working with NNSA on a proposal to upgrade the facility. We think we can increase the laser energy by as much as 30%. And again, this is not a very difficult project. It means adding two more cassettes of laser glass to each of those beam lines. We have the parts and components. I think this also might be an opportunity for a streamlined execution project. It's essentially 192 $3 million projects, so you get many of the attributes that folks in commercial construction can tell you are good. Do the same thing, do it over and over again, and get really good at it. So lots of opportunities, I think, in both of those realms to really show that there's a better way forward and to put some wins on the board. I think we've been building stuff across the enterprise, and we really need some larger scale projects to be big wins, to continue this momentum and build confidence that we can really make these new approaches work.
Tremendous, thank you. And let me thank you both and your teams for your help in documenting those lessons learned and helping FCOG and working with NLDC. I know we drafted late last year with mainly, and you folks all did this, supplemental directives for low and medium risk projects that could be tailored to each mission and site. And again, you brought the experience that you've had on start with the risks and you use proven commercial approaches. And hopefully we can, all get to using that. And, you know, this idea is if we're going to move quickly and improve mission effectiveness, we don't have time to kind of invent our own solutions because there's so many things out there that have worked. So a great report. Let's move on now. We've touched on AI and digital tools. I know the application was used, both said in your opening remarks, it runs the gamut of how do you use it for quality, how do you use it to improve security, production, predictive analytics, research, project delivery, and all those digital tools that we're planning, and then also the step forward with using quantum computing. So could you talk a little bit about what you're doing there, what's worked, and what's next? I know Laura is co-chairing that group on digital tools with Ken Jones, and again, they've shared that with all of us support contractors over the past 2 years. And might talk a little bit about where that's gone, digital thread, and kind of where that's going, and how that's going to enable you to increase mission delivery. So Kim, do you want to start with that one?
Sure. So I'll spend a minute on digital transformation. As John said, Laura McGill has been co-chairing that group since its inception. And the goal there is really to build a modern digital backbone for the nuclear security enterprise. So we talk all the time about how important it is for the labs, plants, and sites to work together as a system, and we do, but we don't have a seamless integration model for how we do that work. So for example, drawings might be created in 3D with some CAD program at a lab. They might be converted to 2D or printed out on paper and transmitted to a production site and redigitized and instantiated in their system. And there are numerous examples across the enterprise where we don't take full advantage of the data that we have, the digital tools that we have, or the ability to use networks to seamlessly connect ourselves. So that team has done many things. They've come together on a set of agreed upon tools that all the sites have said they will use so that we can have standards and standard data formats to transfer between the labs, a schema for how we'll store and manage data as an enterprise. Again, this is very complicated because it's the data that we generate. While there are some unclassified elements to our work, a lot of it is at the secret restricted data level that comes with very specific requirements for controls around that information. For the investments that need to be made in digital capabilities to bring all the sites up to the same level of capacity. So for example, in Kansas City, this is installing classified wireless and creating, you know, a modern smart factory, but in the kind of environment that we need to work in. And so the team is making great progress. There is a lot to do. We talk about how old our infrastructure is. Think about if our facilities are 75 years old, the likelihood they have modern digital infrastructure in them is very low. So there are numerous investments in hardware and software, in upskilling people, and in developing these strategies to connect the enterprise. The goal being that when you start with a design and go through engineering and production, you have a complete digital thread from end to end of what goes into the stockpile, which would be an incredible asset for us as we move forward with modernization. Now, of course, we're doing lots of things, as Tom said, in modeling and simulation, in how we use our most sophisticated modeling and simulation tools in big computers. At my lab, we're home to El Capitan, which is the biggest computer in the world currently that we know about. A mighty improvement in our capability. It's 20 times bigger than our last national security computer. So this is a tool where our designers can do things like run ensembles of full physics 3D simulations in a matter of days. So it is a jaw-dropping increase in our capacity to do the kind of work we need to do to explore the design space that's essential to ensuring that we're confident in the operation of the stockpile and that we're prepared to deliver new capabilities. So LCAP is a hybrid architecture. It's CPUs and GPUs. Very well suited to doing things like AI and we're working with our partners at AMD and HPE to really mature that machine as a tool for AI. You may have heard that all AI is done on NVIDIA machines. We're hopeful to make there be a little bit of diversity in that ecosystem with AMD. So there's a huge amount of work going on in building that scientific toolkit up to make it more capable. What's really happened in the last couple of years is that the enthusiasm and the capability, really, of quantum systems is beginning to become serious. And so we're starting to explore what the possibilities will be for first-generation quantum accelerators. So if the next generation of machine, instead of GPUs, maybe you'll have quantum accelerators. They're very good for a certain subset of the problems that we care about, problems in chemistry, like the explosives problem Tom described, or materials, where you need very, very complex calculations. And so I'm hopeful that as we think about our next generation of big advanced architecture machines, that in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll be thinking about adding quantum to our toolkit. And each of the labs has efforts to both explore quantum computing hardware, how to program quantum computers, and then application of quantum technologies for other purposes.
So maybe just picking up on some of the things that Kim said. First off, in terms of the digital transformation effort, it's really just a feature of timing that the W93 has become the system where a lot of these things are coming together for the first time. Although some of the enhancements are being leveraged for other programs like the 80-4 and the 87-1, the W93 is the first truly relatively clean sheet of paper, new system that's a little further down in the pipeline. Tends to be the case where we'll have the first fully instantiated examples of a lot of this cross-site digital transformation stuff playing out. And that activity is not AI, but it's what I would call AI adjacent, because one of the things it will do is make sure that we have data in a form, in a digital form, that will allow us to leverage it as training data and analysis data of the as-built systems, as compared to the design concept. But that actually then begs another question, which is, okay, for this new system that's being built, from the ground up in a digital environment, we're gonna have all this kind of AI-ready data and documenting the design evolution and the as-built manufacture state. What about all the legacy data? Because we have a wealth of legacy information in our archives, irreplaceable testing data of over 1,000 nuclear tests that forms the basis for our confidence in the stockpile today, and a lot of scientific data about both the modeling and simulation side and the experimental studies. And so we do have a big job getting that into shape to leverage the AI tools. That's where I'm sort of cautiously optimistic that this Genesis mission that was announced before Christmas will provide the framework for doing that. Now, obviously, we haven't yet seen the budget request for FY27, and sitting outside of deliberations, we don't know exactly what's going to be in that, but hopefully it will allow us to get started on unlocking some of the value that's in that decade's worth of data that we're fortunate is not in the training database for all these large language models. But it can be very useful for our mission, and that's something that we're kind of eager to take advantage of. So maybe I'll leave it at that.
I think you hit on something really important that we've been grappling with that I think we should all think about. We've talked about this digital transformation, mostly about the stuff, about the information or the systems or the infrastructure. But really at the heart of this is a culture change. Data is a shared asset, and that's not how data is managed today. It's not how it's managed in the scientific world. It's not how it's managed in site operations even. I've had organizations within my lab have to, that relationship has to be brokered in order for them to share data across boundaries. So this is a really exciting opportunity for us as we build capabilities to really think about a different way of working together, not just across the enterprise, but within each of our sites. The opportunity is really, truly enormous, and I'm hopeful that people will look at this as an opportunity as opposed to a loss, a moment of loss of control.
Great discussion, thank you. Let's go on then, because it, as I said in the introduction, the core of everything we do is safety, security, and quality. We've got to start and maintain that, important to the mission, important to our workers. What roles, as you've continued to make progress, what roles have digital tools played? And I know this idea of streamlining raises the concern, well, it doesn't mean we're going to ignore the rules, but rather using, as we say, a risk-based approach that actually makes us safer and more secure. And then, Kim, you touched on this, and Tom as well. We collect mountains of data on everything we do, safety, security, quality, design, training. How can we use it more effectively using the digital tools? Do you have any examples that you can point to where, you know, we've used it to do problem avoidance as well as problem solving? So, Kim, do you want to start with that one?
Sure. So I'll give you two examples. One is safety enabling. So we have a nuclear facility on our site, the Super Block. The Super Block at one time was a very large-scale enterprise Cat 1 nuclear facility. Around 2010, it was de-inventoried, taken to a much lower material load, but we didn't really update the safety basis under which we operated very effectively. So we're currently in the process of rewriting the documented safety analysis for the Super Block. And so I naively said, well, how fast can we do this? And the typical time to complete one of these rewrites, full rewrites of a DSA, is somewhere between 5 and 10 years. So it is a spectacular undertaking. This is a 1,300-page safety document that I'm confident really only gets read in its complete form once or twice to make sure it's all right. And then workers have to try to use this very complex document to understand how to guide their work in this facility. So our team is using AI tools to build a fully digital documented safety analysis. So the idea would be you'd have all of the information from the document in a form that's queryable, so that when you need a piece of information or you need to make a change, you can ask the system, if I change this rule, requirement, regulation, how does that impact the safety basis for this facility? A worker can go in and say, I work in room X. What are the things I need to understand about the operating environment in that room? And be given back the information most salient to their job. There are about, 12 or more other safety documents that are related to the DSA. They can be integrated into this system so you can understand the interrelationships of each component of the safety basis. So for me, this is taking a very important foundational document that helps us articulate what we think are the most important considerations for safety in this facility and turning it into a living, useful tool for the people who will be working in that facility. So I was not prepared for how exciting this project is. I mean, how exciting could it be to do your documented safety analysis? And it turns out they blew my socks off. It's going to be amazing. And you could imagine, you know, changing this document on a timescale that's salient to how quickly we learn about what's really needed to operate these facilities. So that's my safety enabling example. On the data front, we've done a pilot at the National Ignition Facility. We gather enormous amounts of data on the operation of the laser. So it's full of sensors throughout the entire facility. And that team is using that data with AI tools to put the facility on a predictive maintenance basis. So that instead of having to come in a facility that operates 24/7, you know, instead of having to come in and fix things, we can begin to get ahead of the inevitable maintenance needs of an incredible array of very complex subsystems. And now I'm hopeful we'll be able to take that approach, that toolkit we built, and apply it to maintenance across our site. So we're in the process now of gathering the information on all of the equipment that we manage, monitor, and maintain on the site so that we could begin this process on a site-wide basis. So that's one where I think the data's there. In general, we're not using it in a way that would really allow us to take best advantage.
So just to offer up a couple of Los Alamos examples in this area, I think the first thing that's important to make note of is, the way that I know for sure that we will make zero pits in PF4 is if we're not operating because of a problem with safety or security. This is not a case where somehow there's some tension between our production goals and the imperative to operate safely and securely, because in fact, if it's not safe, we don't run. So the only way to enable production is to get very, very effective at how we ensure that safety and security envelope. So one example from PF4, which Ted Weka mentioned in his remarks, which I'll just elaborate a little bit on, is some changes we've made to how we do nuclear materials control and accountability, which is one of those security requirements. We need to track all of the plutonium all the way through the process to ensure that there's no opportunity for any of it to get diverted in some way. And historically, this has involved periodically shutting down operations so that we can go and account for every fraction of a gram of plutonium, wherever it may be, in a partially manufactured pit, in some machining scrap held up in a process system, whatever it may be. And actually, it takes quite some time to do that. The inventory itself, we've gotten pretty good at. We can knock that out in a couple of days. But on either side of it, we're shutting down processes and then reestablishing it. So it creates this period of 4 to 6 weeks on either, across the whole inventory period where we're not producing. It turns out that we have a lot of systems that we use to track the movement of material through this facility. We have databases for the material accountability. We have databases for crit safety. We have paperwork that gets filled out every time you move a component from one place to another. These already exist. Now, they're in different systems. They don't talk to one another. They actually have different security requirements around them. So we've never really been able to leverage all that information until recently, when we set up an integrated system that takes a look at all these diverse data things and can identify, not quite in real time, so this isn't sort of in-process monitoring in the sense of instantaneous knowledge, but basically in an overnight kind of a way where you compile the data from the previous day and identify if there's any discrepancy. And then you could immediately go and chase that down and find out, what's the origin of this discrepancy? Was some mass not properly logged into the system, or did something, move in a way that we didn't expect, and resolve it long before you ever have to get to an inventory. So what that has allowed us to do for those material balance areas that affect pit production is go to an annual inventory instead of every 6 months. Now, that wasn't an annual inventory, meaning we have a larger uncertainty about the tracking of material, because we're now doing this near real-time tracking where we can find and resolve anomalies the next day instead of waiting 6 months. So I think we've been able to use the data that we were already correcting to both improve our confidence in the security around the material and increase the number of operating weeks in the facility. As Ted mentioned, we need to get up to 40 weeks, and that 4 to 6 weeks that we get by eliminating an inventory is a big contribution to getting to that level. So that's one example. The other example I would cite is in our Lance facility. Lance is a high-power proton accelerator that we use for proton radiography. We use it to produce medical isotopes. We use it to create radiation environments that are important for qualifying electronics that have to work in kind of difficult environments, and a variety of other purposes. Very flexible facility, but the backbone is this linear accelerator that's over 50 years old. And that linear accelerator has thousands of control points. By control points, I mean the current in a magnet that you need to adjust, or the phasing of the RF in a particular section of the accelerator, or the temperature of the cooling rod. So thousands and thousands, probably close to 100,000 control points that are knobs that have to be turned every time you turn on the machine. And because it's an old machine, it's a little bit crotchety. And so after it's been down for maintenance for a period of time and you go to switch it on, you find that there are bits of it that don't quite wake up as quickly as you would like, and they wake up in a different state than they were in before you turned it off. And you have to go through this laborious process of finding the sweet spot to, you know, minimize the losses so you're not activating the machine and getting all the current out the other end. Well, it turns out this is a perfect application for AI. And in fact, we've been making a lot of progress developing an AI-driven mechanism for tuning up the accelerator. And what that's allowing us to do is reduce the amount of time we're turning knobs and increase the amount of time that we've got beam on target. And, you know, it's all about beam on target when we're trying to, you know, use proton radiography to understand plutonium aging, as we did this fall for the first time in, I think, over 15 years. So that's another example where the data's all there, and it's hard for the human brain to comprehend how all of these different parameters interact with one another, but it's a perfect example where AI can look at the optimization it's trying to do in terms of minimizing losses, maximizing beam at the other end, and very quickly iterate to the kind of operation sweet spot for that machine.
Well, great discussion, thank you. And you hit on a key point, and I know we had a field manager's panel just before this, but as I said in the introduction, this progress is enabled by a partnership with our MSA counterparts, and you think about everything that we've done in the last year has been as a result of this partnership where, you know, the field managers working with us on a daily, weekly basis to implement those changes and then assess what works and find the next things to focus on. And I think some people understand that means streamlining means less MSA interaction, and really streamlining is not less MSA interaction, it's actually more, and they're more frequent, but it's problem-solving mode of helping us enable these, because I know the things both of you have talked about have been, okay, so this worked. Now, the next month, let's do this, and then incrementally, we'll do this. So I'm glad you mentioned that. I think that kind of partnership was only going to strengthen our ability to achieve the streamlining initiative and good results. Let's go down to people, because we're only as good as our people. So what are the successes and challenges you've had? I know they've changed from COVID to all of the AI industry competing for your people, and then cyber. So what are the successes, challenges you've had in attracting and retaining the workforce to support your missions? And if you would include in that, how do you engage them in these streamlining efforts to get their good ideas as they join the team to help us find even incrementally better ways to deliver the mission? So Kim, you want to start with that one?
Sure. So on the good news front, our mission has never been more important. We have an enormous amount of work, very interesting and impactful work that needs to be done. We have an incredibly motivated workforce, and we've had really good luck with recruiting and retaining that workforce through focused efforts. On the challenging front, the AI companies have hired away a number of people. For us, fusion companies have also been a big attraction for many of our employees. And of course, people should pursue their careers and, you know, follow their passions. That's all great. I spend a lot of time giving people the door goes in both directions speech. That if this adventure doesn't work out, please come back. We would love to have you back. So on the whole, we're doing very well with recruiting and retention. What's been interesting for us is we've grown a lot over the last 5-7 years, almost doubling the size of our workforce, which has engendered an enormous demographic shift. So at this point, 50% of our staff has been at the lab less than 5 years, 75% less than 10 years. And so this is the first time since maybe 1970 the lab had those demographics. And this workforce wants something different out of the workplace. One is they don't have the history of the lab and decades of experience in our environment. That's good. They're open to new things. They have new ideas about ways to do things. They want to be empowered to make decisions, to manage risk, to move quickly. They're used to working in a fully digital environment. They're used to having modern tools on their desktop. And so this has been a real motivator for us to change the way our workplace works. And so it's spurred our efforts in expanding access to new digital tools, for example, bringing the big AI models into our system so people could have access to them for their work. That was a big priority for us, and I think it was really important for engaging our workforce, giving them access to tools to learn how to use AI tools and other things in their research. Using our internal research and development funding, our LDRD programs, to really spur efforts on advanced manufacturing, on high energy density science, in computing, in advanced tools, in understanding the way that AI will change how we deliver our missions, and investing in our site. And I think for us, one of the biggest challenges we have being in California is if you go to the average private sector employer in Silicon Valley and see the kind of campus environment that they provide for their employees and the kind of perks they provide, you know, we're never going to provide that. It's just not, it's not within the realm of the possible. That said, we could do much better. And so I put a huge focus on investing in the kinds of infrastructure improvements that will really directly benefit our employees and make their quality of life, their work environment better. That's why I have such a big focus on office infrastructure for us. We really need modern office space to accommodate this new workforce and really show them that we're gonna make investments in them for the long term to keep them at the site and to give them the kind of modern workspace they wanna work in. So that, you know, there will always be compromises. We do high consequence national security work. Working in classified environments requires some modifications. Leave your cell phones outside, no smartwatches. But we can provide a lot more and a lot richer digital environment for them in those environments today than we could even just a couple of years ago. I think that's going to be very important to keeping those folks. And if we keep them for 5 years, they tend to stick.
Yeah, I think our situation is one where we're increasingly looking at that tend to stick question. You know, we went through a period of very significant growth. Probably our peak year for hiring was 2023. We were around 2,400 new staff. We're now at about half that level, and most of those staff are replacements for people retire and move to other jobs. We still have some growth to experience, you know, over the next few years, but it's at a much more kind of measured pace. And in general, I think we've done quite well in terms of the quality of people that we're attracting. And now the real question is, can we retain them? You know, particularly as they start to become proficient, because in our business it takes, you know, it can take a couple of years to really become proficient. You may have to get a security clearance, and then you, only then can you really start learning the ins and outs of our business. And so it's really not a good model for us to have people turning over on the timescale of a couple of years. I mean, there are some private sector companies that can operate in that mode, but it's not good for us. We want people to, you know, build their careers in the lab. Now, the good thing is that large and diverse organizations like Livermore and Los Alamos, we can offer people opportunities to kind of change their job every couple of years without leaving the institution, take the skills they've built up and apply it in a different mission area. So I think the potential is there. What we see is that we tend to have particular areas where we have retention challenges. It's not across the board. Overall, our retention rate, although it got kind of hectic a few years ago, with, you know, we were in double-digit attrition rates. Well, now we're back down to what I would call the historical norm, which is 5 to 6% attrition. But within that, there are certain skill sets that we do struggle because they're just highly, highly competitive. And I think that's an area where, you know, we're having a dialogue with NNSA about getting some more flexibility on some of the ways that we do our compensation and retention to allow us to respond more quickly. I think when we've seen those challenges in the past, we've been able to respond, but sometimes it can take a year or two to actually make the case. We saw this a few years ago when we were struggling with our craft workforce, because in the southeastern part of New Mexico, you may have heard there's this thing called the Permian Basin. If you're an electrician or pipe fitter, you know, skilled craft, you can make a whole lot of money there with a ton of overtime. And our craft numbers were going down at the exact moment we needed them to go up. So we're a research lab, so we decided to do an experiment. We had a hypothesis. The hypothesis was, if we pay people better, they'll be less inclined to leave.
That's amazing.
And so we did the experiment. We got approval to do a targeted incentive for high-demand skilled craft. And lo and behold, if you look at the curve of our craft workforce, you can identify the week where we implemented that. We went from slope negative to slope positive. So that's a great story, except it took us 2 years. So that meant we had 2 years of losing craft while we were making the case that it was okay to pay people more, because the concern was, well, you know, is there cost reasonableness in this if you're gonna pay people more? Now, turns out, it's a whole lot cheaper to get the job done quickly. So, you know, in terms of, does it save the government money to pay people less? The answer is no, because what's going to happen is you're not going to get it done. You're going to have a big cost overrun and a standing army cost associated with stretching things out. So it actually made more sense for the federal government to pay a more competitive wage for those workers and not lose them. And we do have some areas where I think that same thing applies. You know, we're doing pretty well in terms of the craft now, because there are other disadvantages to going working in the Permian Basin, including living in a trailer away from your family and so forth. So as long as we're close, we can make the case. But the supervision for the craft, for example, is another area. And I prefer that as those challenges arise, we don't get into a two-year dialogue about what's the cost reasonableness. You know, we need to be able to respond to those market conditions and not suffer the attrition, because the retraining cycle is very, very expensive, and the delay cycle is even more expensive. But I'd say, you know, by and large, we're doing pretty well in terms of the staff. They're incredibly motivated by the mission. And I think a lot of these efforts to streamline things are going to help us in terms of retention, because it's a huge quality of, you know, people come to the lab to do a job. And if there's a tax on their time doing something that's low value added, that saps morale. And if we can relieve that burden so that they can spend more time on task, that's going to increase our stickiness for all those staff that we've hired. And for that reason, they tend to be a really good source of ideas as to what should we do. I had an all-manager meeting last week, and I said, you know, everyone in the audience who spent some time this past week doing something that they don't think adds much value, put up your hand. Well, guess what? Every hand in the audience, including mine, went up, and that is the source of ideas of the next problem we've got to go work. It's, you know, probably the most innovative thing we could do is do less dumb stuff. And if we can just do that, then, you know, amazing things will happen.
That's true. I want to make one more point that I forgot, which is we're also working with NNSA and DOE on streamlining the way we work with the private sector. So, for example, with the AI companies, I would much rather have them create a partnership with us and work with my very high-value national security experts as employees of the lab so that I have them available for my mission. They get some exposure to the industry, but they get to stay in my environment. Similarly with fusion, give them an opportunity to work on the problems that industry cares about, but stay in the lab environment so that I have them in the mix when I have national security work that needs to be done. And I think that's another opportunity area for the government to rethink these sort of brittle and slow-moving agreement structures we have with how we do cooperative research with the private sector.
Great discussion and great example. Thank you. So we're going to have one more question. We're down to our last 16 minutes, and then we'll take some audience questions. But to kind of wrap this up, you've said, and you gave some great examples, a lot of good streamlining initiatives this last year. The multi-year effort on requirements reform and MSA, Deputy Administrator Papano's initiative outline in his October 17th memo, Project Velocity, all these other things that we're working on. But the question, as you were saying, for our people and for our mission, what really moves the needle? So could you talk about, as a wrap-up question, what are some of the things this administration did in the first year that MSA did that had a really strong benefit to the MSA National Security Mission at your site and across the board? And then, and kind of add to that, what's the one thing you'd encourage DOE and MSA to pursue in the next 3 years to really, again, move the needle and have lasting benefit for the way we conduct the national security mission? So, Kim, do you want to start with that one, please?
Sure. So I think the biggest thing for us has been the meaningful action on regulatory reform. We've talked about regulatory reform with each new administration as they come in. Everyone is very enthusiastic. Committees are formed, ideas are generated, white papers are written, and really nothing changes. I would say what's happening right now is that the rule sets are being reevaluated and rewritten on a timescale that's breathtaking. And so I've shifted from, you know, encouraging people to get involved and try to drive the process to warning people that we will be the dog who caught the car. And so when we get relief from some of these requirements, we have to be ready to show the kinds of benefits that we have been saying will accrue if you relieve these different types of regulations. So I think that shift and the meaningful action that's being taken right now is very exciting and is a huge opportunity for the enterprise. And it's everything from safety and security to business processes to project management to construction, dot, dot, dot. All those things are, it's a target-rich opportunity, target-rich environment in that case. And again, as Tom said, safety, security, good stewardship of the taxpayer dollar, transparency to our partners in the government, these are all really important. We are doing those things. The question is, are we adding baggage to those things that obscure the really important questions on those topics? In the next couple of years, you know, as I mentioned earlier on infrastructure, I would like to see us take some really bold steps and pick some big projects in this commercial-like space to do under these streamlined authorities. Fully commercial-like, go forth and build, as a completely self-serving example, the National Security Innovation Center at Livermore, this giant office complex, and show what's possible. You know, really release us, unleash us in this space to do big things and show that we can be trusted to execute on those priorities. I think that would be super exciting. And, you know, I realize there are a lot of priorities in the system and huge pressures on our budgets and enormous priorities in the production enterprise. You know, we have an opportunity, a once-in-a-generation opportunity to foundationally change the way we work. That's tools, technology, approaches, infrastructure, people, and we would be well-served to really take some big swings in the next couple of years on that front.
Yeah, I think there is a difference this time around. So I've been doing this lab director thing for a while, and I remember in 2007 when we transitioned from the Bush administration to the Obama administration, we had a new energy secretary named Steve Chu, who happened to have been a lab director and was really passionate about trying to come up with more sensible ways of doing things, and he went to the lab director's council and said, I want you to give me a list of all the burdensome practices that you think are unnecessary, don't add value, add cost, add time. And so we came up with this, we came up with a list of, 110 items, and then we, recognized that some of them were duplicative and bit them down into a smaller set of groups and came up with this burdensome practices memo. It resulted in me having to testify before Congress, along with other people, lots of discussion. So some, I would say, valuable improvements that were made as a result of it, but to be honest, nothing really transformational. People like to say, physicists anyway, like to say that entropy is the arrow of time. In fact, that's not correct. Bureaucracy is the arrow of time. And so, in a system that tends to accrete more process, I think the prior exercise just slowed down the rate of accretion modestly. We did the same thing as we transitioned from the Obama administration into the first Trump administration, made a list. Had another list for transitioning from first Trump administration to Biden administration. The lists that we made this time wasn't that different from those previous lists. Actually, if you look, it was basically the same suggestions. They were good ideas in 2008. I think they were still good ideas in 2025. The difference was, actually, after we sent this in, Secretary Wright signed out a memo within about a month implementing a bunch of them. At which point we went, oh, this is different. I think at this point, the ones that were implemented in that first Secretary Wright memo were in some sense the low-hanging fruit. They were things that we specifically chose because we knew that with a single secretarial action, you could make that change. The phase that we're in now is much harder, and you mentioned Project Velocity is sort of taking this on, looking at, I think, 80 orders, and that's real in the trenches, hard work, because if all those people in my old manager meeting who put up their hands and said, in the past week I did something that didn't add a lot of value, didn't make sense. If you say, okay, we're not going to do things that don't make sense, the very next question is, what does make sense? Because we're not talking about eliminating all possible constraint on what we're doing. We want to do the things that are necessary to ensure that we, produce what we need to produce to support the mission. We don't hurt people, we don't harm the environment, we're respectful of taxpayer resources. And the what does make sense question is a pretty tough one. When you've got to work it through, in this case, 80 different DOE orders. Even though we know there's a lot of stuff that doesn't make sense, they were written for a reason. They were modified probably in response to some occurrence, that led to corrective action plans and a new set of requirements. And so the exercise of going through and saying what does make sense is going to be harder than the kind of first wave where, to some extent, with a stroke of a pen in the secretarial memo, you could relieve something. So it's going to require staying power. And I think it's also going to be really important that we, in the operations of all of these facilities across the country, are able to demonstrate that our safety performance hasn't degraded, our speed has improved, and our cost effectiveness has improved. Because otherwise, guess what? In 3 years or in 7 years or whenever, we'll just find ourselves snapping back. I think the way that we ensure that we make durable changes is by being able to demonstrate that we were still able to protect material, we were still able to protect classified information, we were still able to protect our workforce, we were still able to protect the public. But guess what? We got more done, and we saved money. And at that point, I think the changes will be durable, because any administration that comes in, no matter what their ideological viewpoint, wants to get stuff done, and they recognize that there's not an infinite amount of money.
Well, I just say thank you. I'm just excited to hear all the progress being made and potential for the future. And I think you both said it very well. The thing of the last year is we're being challenged to implement these changes quickly. And that's what energizes all of us, of course, all of the people, is that sense of urgency to change the way we work. And also within 3 years, institutionalize the way of doing business. Because we all know, and our workers certainly know, as we're trying to hire them and retain them, the importance of the national security mission is to deliver against the current threat and then have those, as you work every day, have that rapid response capability as new threats evolve. And the only way we do that is to get more work done with the funds we have and work very quickly as the problems come up to solve them and then take the next one and the next one. With that, why don't we have time for a few questions from the audience. So I know we've got some microphones out there.
So while we wait for the question, John, I call that the power of unreasonable expectations. You have to stretch the system beyond where it feels comfortable in order to get those kind of changes.
Is it on?
Okay.
Thank you for your presentations. Could you comment on what percentage of the workforce at your labs is are foreign nationals? And if you've been impacted by some of the administration's changes regarding scientific visas and exchanges?
Sure, so the thing that has impacted us is in the defense authorization last year, there was a restriction that prohibited citizens of five countries of concern who were not U.S. permanent residents access to the NNSA sites. The countries included Russia, China, North Korea, Iran,
Cuba
was added to the list. And we did have some non-permanent resident, primarily postdocs, who were impacted by that, and so we had to let about 60 people go. We do have foreign nationals working, obviously, in unclassified open research activities. For the vast majority of what we do, it tends to be sort of sensitive, requires a Q clearance, which typically requires U.S. citizenship. But we're a diverse, multi-program lab, and we do fundamental research that's a long way away from classified or export controls and any of those things, and so for that reason we have